are now plugged in to the Delphi podcast.
Hey everyone, my name is Jan Lieberman. I head up our Ventures division, and I'm excited to host select episodes of the pod. Today we have Guy Young, who's the founder and CEO of Athena Labs. Athena is looking to create what's called the Internet Bond. And the idea is that it's a fully collateralized stablecoin with a fully crypto native yield. The stablecoin is collateralized with staked ETH and a short ETH per position, and these two exposures offset, creating a delta neutral exposure. Both of these exposures also typically offer a yield. Through the long staked ETH position, you're getting ETH staking yield. Through the short per position, you're collecting a funding rate from the market that usually pays to be long. The magic is in the details, and that's part of what I'd love to chat through today. So really appreciate you joining. Would be great to start off with your background, you know, how you got into crypto and what led you to building this.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me on. It was my introduction to crypto was late 2019. I had a friend who was a DeFi founder back then, and he introduced me straight to Ethereum and all the applications that were being built on them. And that was just before the first wave of DeFi summer really hit. So it was stuff like MakerDAO, Synthetix. And that was immediately what sort of interested me within crypto was basically DeFi. And I think it was just pretty fortunate timing before the market started to take off in 2020 when I sort of got into it. I was doing that on the side of my day job where I was working in TradFi and just investing into it on the side of my day job until when Luna went down in 22. That was basically Arthur came out with a thought piece a few days after that where he sort of described how he might think about a scalable crypto native dollar. And his basic idea was long BTC on one side and short the inverse perp on the other to create that synthetic dollar exposure that you described in the beginning. And yeah, read his piece, was quite inspired by it and thought we could do it with a few small adjustments and basically just quit my job to start doing what we're doing with Athena.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I remember us meeting back in the beginning of DeFi summer and chatting. And it's funny how, you know, back then we were seeing each other what new stable forms or what new yield forms are launching. And it's pretty poetic. Now we've gotten to, I think it's a sign of the maturing of the industry and into a product that's, you know, completely sustainable, much more protected. And so I think, you know, going down that path, would love to kind of dive into the landscape of the stablecoin market, particularly this product itself. And has it been attempted before and what you think is different now that wasn't really feasible before?
Yeah, I think you could broadly categorize the market into three, four different areas. So you obviously got the fiat stablecoins fully collateralized and essentially just what's happening there is you've got a T-bill or some sort of US Treasury sitting within an SPV or a bank. The issuer is issuing a receipt against that token, and typically the large dominant players there, whether it's Tether or USDC, are internalizing most of the return from that product themselves. So you can sort of think about it like a bank, which is on the deposit side, its users taking out the stablecoin, and then they're just internalizing sort of that net interest margin to themselves as issuers, which obviously looks like a great business model when you're doing that at an enormous scale, like you're seeing with Tether now. There's a new crop that looks slightly similar to that, which I think picked up a bit of popularity during the bear market, where it's sort of RWA-linked stablecoins now, where essentially instead of the issuer capturing most of those returns, they're pushing it out to users on the other side. I think there are some concerns, and I'm happy to sort of jump into where those concerns lie around sort of the viability of that type of product at scale, whether it's regulatory driven or whether that type of protocol can actually ever extract value to themselves. But yeah, that's sort of like one new theme that we've sort of seen come through this year, where I think one of the most dominant narratives that we've seen is obviously just like rates going to 5, and that had a big impact in terms of both crypto rates on chain and in the broader market, and the new products that sort of brought within crypto as well. I think another popular one that we've seen through the years, but really is quite dominated by Maker, is the CDP design. So you're putting down some form of crypto collateral on one side and then borrowing the stablecoin into existence. I think it had some use case, which is always being sort of linked to the demand for leverage on the asset that you're actually putting down. But the limitations there have always been it's not that scalable and it's quite capital inefficient because you're obviously putting down more collateral than you're bringing into existence with the stablecoin on the other side. And I think we've seen a bit of a thesis drift with some of those types of projects where really originally Maker had the vision of being an actually decentralized crypto native dollar. And since the introduction of USDC and then later RWAs, there was obviously just a bit of a drift in terms of what the actual proposition was of that product, where now it's mostly sort of a wrapper for RWA rates that are just distributed on chain. And then, the final bucket, which I think is where Athena is falling under and has been attempted, I think, in a slightly different flavor in the past, is this idea of a delta neutral design. So you're putting in some form of crypto collateral and then delta hedging the exposure on the other side. What's interesting about that is obviously it only requires $1 of collateral going into the system to create $1 of stablecoin. But I think the issues that we saw in the past and some of the learnings that we sort of took on before starting out with Athena was those previous designs had tried to do it in a fully decentralized way, i.e. built fully on-chain with derivatives there. And really just the market there is just not big enough or anywhere near the size that you need to grow this into a product where we think the demand actually sits, which is in the billions. So for reference, we did see a project back in 2021 called UXT on Solana. They tried to build a pretty similar idea. It was with BTC and Sol on Mango Market. But part of the issues that they immediately ran into is that open interest on that market was sub $100 million at that period of time. And if you compare that to sort of CeFi open interest at the moment, it's close to $20 billion on just BTC and ETH. So we're really talking about a delta in 200x in terms of the market size. And obviously that just has a large impact in terms of the size that you can actually think about growing this product. So for us, it was really just thinking about maximizing your ability to scale in the beginning, making trade-offs in the beginning to achieve that scalability, and then just being very honest with our users around what are those trade-offs and could you ever sort of think about moving more towards decentralization afterwards. I just had a slightly different difference in opinion and view in terms of what users find important. And I think actually getting a scalable, pragmatic outcome in the beginning is something that people sort of value more than decentralized theatrics.
Very much with you. I think treating kind of decentralization in a binary way makes building in it really difficult, where everything comes with trade-offs. And the idea of complete decentralization is great, but likely going from 95% to 99% often comes at the expense of UX or market size or a host of other things. And so I think it's really compelling what you guys are doing is making that trade-off in the right place. The trade-off being you're dealing with central exchanges as a counterparty to some extent in exchange for the ability to leverage the amount of open interest that exists on those platforms versus DEXs. But I'd love to for you to kind of go into the innovation and the kind of optimization that you guys are doing on that front to also, mitigate your direct counterparty risk to these centralized exchanges, especially in the light of FTX and what's kind of taking place over the past years.
Yeah, we can jump into that. And I think it's probably also just worth pointing out, this is part of the argument that Arthur actually had in his article, which was, actually trying to provide something here that is perfectly decentralized. Really, you got to think about, I think those broad terms that you were describing in much more narrow ways, if you're going to be clear about what you're actually trying to achieve. And so for us, it was thinking within that word decentralization. With a stablecoin in particular, what I think you're trying to actually solve for is actually just censorship resistant around where is the collateral sitting. And so when the entire market is basically just got T-bills and bonds sitting within the US banking system, that's obviously a risk vector which is shared between all of those issuers. And for us, it was just really trying to provide something which did not have that same exposure of bonds sitting within a US bank, basically. And so, yeah, for us, it was thinking about how do we move that into exposure within the crypto ecosystem? And so that's broadly defined as like entities that are within crypto, whether it's exchanges, custodians, or DeFi itself. And one like really interesting development that we've seen post FTX is the emergence of off-exchange custody solutions. So as you know, like traditional market structures don't have trading, settlement, execution, and custody all jammed together within one entity, which is what you see within crypto. That's sort of separated into isolated functions. And really what we've seen on the custodial side is an ability now to actually hold the collateral assets outside of centralized exchanges while still accessing their liquidity on the other side. So for us, that was a really interesting unlock where, yes, it's not perfectly decentralized. Yes, you are putting trust into an entity to hold your assets. But for us, we thought it was just interesting connective tissue between DeFi and CeFi where you didn't have to put your trust in a bit of a black box exchange. You could still have it in a transparent wallet there with a custodian. And I think when we look back empirically just on the data, yes, we can talk about trustless execution within DeFi, but I think we'd all admit that there's been serious challenges in terms of actually doing that in a safe and secure way. So I think the last number I saw in the last 3 years was north of $7 billion of hacks within DeFi. And TVL now is like just over $50 billion. So I don't know what like sort of probability of default that you're assigning to holding your assets within a smart contract, but that doesn't look very good, right? It's a bit cooler between 5 to 10% of the time you're putting your money in a smart contract, you're getting zeroed on the other side. So for us, yes, it doesn't sort of like tick all the boxes in terms of the normal type of execution you'd see within DeFi. But I think if we just look at the data and just ask ourselves, has it been safer to leave your money in a centralized exchange, a smart contract, or an institutional grade custodian. It's actually institutional grade custodians which have been sort of the safest place just on looking at the data.
Makes a lot of sense. And that's kind of the explanation on paper, and would love to kind of dive into how it operates in practice, you know, creation, redemption, yield capture.
Yeah, so we could sort of walk through just maybe like the flows of the assets coming into the system. So it's slightly different between what's happening with market makers on the back end and then users who are just coming into the synthetic dollar itself. So really we try to like abstract away a lot of the complexity and just have an interface which is swapping from other stable coins into USDE. So when a user comes in to swap in from USDT to USDE, they're routed through to a curve pool on the other side, which slightly imbalances the price of the assets within that pool. That then creates an arbitrage opportunity for a market maker to come in and bring liquid staking tokens to our contract, which is the mint and redeem. So essentially, when the price of USDE has gone up in that curve pool by a small amount, a market maker has an incentive to bring us STETH or some other form of liquid staking token, and then they can mint one USDE in return, less execution costs, and sell it down in the curve pool to close the arbitrage. And so really all that's happening there is that dollar-denominated flows that are occurring to have like demand to come into the product incentivize market makers to essentially come and do that mint and redeem with Athena to bring us new collateral. When that collateral is coming into our system, it's quite simple in terms of what's happening on-chain with the smart contract. It's just taking in that collateral. It's looking at centralized exchange, order books, and funding, and then just working out where is it most efficient for us to hedge that collateral. This is all happening before a block is actually confirmed within Ethereum. So you've obviously got up to 12 seconds to actually issue that stablecoin, which makes it quite helpful for us to go and source that short-side liquidity on exchanges on the other side, which is obviously operating on milliseconds rather than 12 seconds. And really, we just send out the call to the exchange, hedge the collateral, and then send it through to an institutional-grade custodian, where the assets are sitting there within a Fireblocks, Copper, those type of entities. And the key piece here is that we're not issuing the stablecoin until the confirmation of the hedge has been confirmed. And that way we're sort of ensuring that every dollar that's coming in is always sort of perfectly hedged on day one before stablecoin is issued on the other side.
Appreciate it. And from the perspective of kind of the retail user who isn't really going to be interacting with this much, this is all kind of, you know, happening on the back end and ensuring that pegs are maintained and the appropriate collateral is there. How does the experience look from, you know, the majority of people that are going to be using it with smaller denominations, not these institutional players that are going to be interacting with the market makers?
Yeah, it really just looks like a basic Uniswap type swap interface where you're just being rerouted into the AMM pools at the back. Have a pretty simple sort of staking interface where you're just taking the dollar to then stake and capture the yield. But yeah, it looks no different to just a swap that you'd see within DeFi. And it's quite similar, like what I just described there is the way the mechanics work in the background is actually quite similar to how you deal with Tether and Circle, right? So I'm sure you've dealt with 8-9 figures of stablecoins in your life. I don't know how many times you've been to the Tether and Circle like website yourself to do anything there. You typically sort of just leaving that paper in the background to be doing those arbs. And I think we sort of view stablecoin applications as slightly different to most applications where you're not really providing a user experience within the app. You're actually just providing a product that is sort of disseminated to where there is demand for it. That's also that's provided on the front end, which is just a swap to get into that.
Thanks. And so now to dive into some of the numbers themselves as part of the DD process and just chatting with you a bunch, it was great to kind of think through this and various scenarios. And it's a really interesting kind of setup because of all the first and second order effects and how they kind of move the markets and move rates. But yeah, maybe just starting with the two sources of yield and then how they've evolved and what that kind of creates for you in terms of expectations for the top line number.
Yeah, sure. So as you said, the interesting piece about this is that you're sort of getting paid on both sides typically. That these numbers obviously change through time, but we can just describe what we've seen historically. So just starting with staked ETH, you obviously have a positive carry now to being long staked ETH on one side. That yield has drifted down pretty significantly over the last, call it 12 to 18 months, from somewhere that was close to 6 to now sitting somewhere that's close to 3.5-4%. What is interesting about that yield, and I think when you compare it to the basis that you're capturing within SEXs as well, is that these are really the only two like forms of scalable yield within crypto. If you think about the whole like economy that DeFi is actually built on, it's basically just trying to reuse the single source of yield and RWAs at the moment. And it's actually not an enormous yield to sort of share with all of the applications that are actually trying to build businesses on top of it. And so for us, what was really interesting about this is that you've got hundreds of projects that are trying to extract some sort of value from providing financial products around that staked ETH return. But actually the basis within the centralized exchange market is a larger gross cash flow stream than you see from staked ETH products like Lido staked ETH. And really, there's no one who's putting together like a vehicle to actually just bring that yield, whether it's into DeFi or exporting it as like a as a product into TradFi as well. So yeah, it was interesting to us that really there's only two forms of crypto scalable, like scalable crypto native yield. And this is really the first instrument where you're jamming them together, which we think is quite interesting. The second piece around the basis is that obviously varies quite a bit through time. So one thing we've observed is like beginning of bull market, those numbers can get pretty extreme. So you can think about the funding rate that's attached to these contracts as really just an interest rate that's expressing the demand and supply imbalance for capital within the system. So people within crypto, when things are going strong, are wanting to get longer than 1x their net worth. And there's obviously just a cost to that leverage. And people outside of the system who have extreme skepticism around crypto are like unwilling to lend that capital into the system, where you start to see these interest rates push beyond like 20, 30, 40% in the right conditions. And that's what we've seen in the last quarter as we sort of saw the run up from the ETF speculation as well. So these rates obviously vary through time, but just to sort of describe what we've seen over the last quarter, it's been averaging closer to 20%. In December, it was between 26 to 30-ish% to be short BTC and ETH contracts. And that's pretty consistent with the data that you're seeing at the beginning of 2021, where that those sort of rates were north of 40% and averaged up 20% through the year. They do dip down quite a bit during the bear market, as you'd imagine, like as the demand for leverage sort of subsides a bit. But one thing that we thought was quite interesting about this is looking back at 2022 as a test case for like how bad could things get in terms of the funding rate. It actually only averaged like around 0% for the entire year, which I think gave us quite a bit of comfort that, yes, this can be like an interesting product during the bull market, and there's potential for that to obviously like create a lot of cash flow on like large numbers of stablecoin supply. But it's actually like thinking about, is this going to be a product that actually survives three cycles? And for us, when you put together that staked ETH yield with the average funding that you're seeing at the bottom of the 2022 bear market, it gave us some sort of comfort that this is actually a product that could sort of like live through those cycles.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. So what's interesting is if you look at the relationship also between the staked ETH yield and the funding rate, if you think about what the primary drivers are, right? ETH yield is on-chain activity, and the funding rate yield is, like you mentioned, demand to go long. And so if you think about kind of the relationship, you want those to be uncorrelated or even negatively correlated to some extent in times of stress, especially because, you know, you don't want both yields to kind of come down and then you have a product with no or potentially negative yield. And so if you think about kind of the market dynamic, you know, in a bull market, everything works, it's great, crypto is amazing. And then it's when dominoes start to fall and every potential stress test possible will take place. And so you have here is if you think about the beginning of a bear market, everything is nuking, everything is blowing up, but on-chain activity is still very high. And so you have this buffer of the staking yield on ETH being very high when the funding potentially is negative or close to zero. And then you get to the next bear stage is kind of apathy, where you have low on-chain activity, so the staking yield is high, but you don't necessarily have this massive appetite to short. Good thing is you have many months where you have high ETH staking yield and potentially negative yield, where like that overlap happens. And it basically allows the protocol to kind of not delever, because it's not necessarily levered, but just condense in terms of the outstanding supply. And so we'd love to kind of go into, you know, the mechanics behind like what the environment would be for redemptions or what's happening and how you anticipate things playing out when you have this scenario where yields are compressing and there's potentially, you know, some redemptions that are happening as it condenses to a more market appropriate range of supply.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of comments around that. I think the first one that's also worth just like pointing out is the existence of baseline funding on a lot of the key venues. So on Binance, Bybit, BitGet, it's more than sort of like 65-ish percent of open interest. There's this concept of where funding is within a band, it's just reverting to the set standard rate of around 11% per year. And so actually when like the markets cooled off and after that liquidation that we saw just leading into the ETF news, that was a moment there, right, where you sort of wiped out a significant amount of the open interest within the market. And all it did was reset down from like the 30s to the 11%. So the only moments that you really see like things go negative and actually hold there for like even beyond a week are events where there's like a Luna, a 3 hours, or an FTX. But what we do observe is that that's like a very temporary period where even in those extreme stress scenarios, it sort of dips negative and then mean reverts pretty quickly to that baseline funding. And so, yeah, I agree with you. As you're sort of unwinding into a bear, obviously the rates are going to be lower. But this sort of more technical explanation for how they're actually calculating the funding on these contracts means that in like even lightly bearish scenarios, it's still a pretty positive number through time. I think the bigger point there, and it's one that you're alluding to when you're talking about like the redemptions and how we sort of think about the supply adjusting to the market, is Just to be like totally clear, we're not afraid of a negative interest rate or afraid of low funding or all of these things. It's just a market set interest rate, right? All that interest rate is telling you is like, is the supply of this stablecoin too big or too small relative to the market itself? And so you're looking at that interest rate right now, annualizing 26% in December. It means like the supply of USD is way too small relative to the market size because that interest rate for an unlevered cash and carry is way too high, right? And so capital needs to flow in there and compress that yield to something that makes a bit more sense. Equally, if and when we ever get to a size where we're actually influencing the size of that market and yields go low or negative, that's just a sign that the supply of the stablecoin is too big and it needs to shrink down to a new equilibrium. And so I think the way that we think about this philosophically is that these are all market forces and you never want to be stepping in between them and trying to force anything or hard code any number within that type of system, because it just leads to more painful breakages down the road. And so for us, it's like, yes, there's going to be a market rate that people are willing to hold this product. And if that sort of falls low or negative, it just means people need to redeem, we need to shrink, and then you sort of allow it to go to a new clearing interest rate. So yeah, don't want to dismiss the risk around the funding, but I think for us, it was really core to the design of, we wanted this exogenous interest rate there to actually like calibrate the supply of the stablecoin.
And just seeing kind of down the risk side, I think, you know, crypto has a lot of reflexivity built in. It's you know, a feature and a bug to some extent. And so you have the reflexivity in various forms. You know, price is a fundamental characteristic at this point. And so you have a lot of kind of serial correlation there. And also, you know, within DeFi, particularly on the insurance fund side, you know, you have the governance token that acts as an insurance fund for the protocol. But the problem is when you need to rely on that insurance because something's gone wrong, the token price nukes. And so, you know, it's very misaligned where it's needed most, it's cheapest. And so you're kind of dumping into no bids and the design is kind of flawed. Whereas here, you know, your insurance fund grows as you know, it's a portion of fees. And so when things are going well, supply is very large and the yields are high. So your insurance fund is growing really well. And then when times are tough, the supply contracts. So it's actually beneficial because now the supply is effectively the liability. And so as the liability contracts and you have the insurance fund there, I think that's a really elegant kind of offsetting thing. So I'd love to kind of dive into what the role of the insurance fund is and how it would be used in kind of scenarios.
Yeah. The basic idea behind it was like, we can obviously talk about delta neutral designs being like perfectly capital efficient out one-to-one. But I think we know the practical reality of these things when you're doing it at scale is that there's going to be pieces here or there. And as you say, you've got to sort of assume that at some point through a full four-year crypto cycle, like every small piece that can go wrong probably will. And so for us, it was really, we just got our arms around the data that we saw around negative funding. And instead of just sort of constantly telling people that they shouldn't be worried about it, we thought it'd just be easier to get a pool of basically just dollars sitting behind USD itself, which can sit there for like a rainy day fund if you ever do need to pay down that negative funding. What's interesting about that as well is you can obviously use that capital to sit within our custodians and exchange accounts as well to slightly over collateralize the position within those accounts. And obviously now you have an ability to actually earn interest on those dollars that are sitting there. And so what's quite interesting about the yield that you're obviously receiving on just holding dollars in an account is that we think that that's, again, negatively correlated to the yields you'll see on this product. So RWA rates are high. That's obviously closer to the bottom of the crypto cycle where there's like low speculation, low demand for long leverage. But what we saw last cycle was when RWA rates went from like 1 to 0, obviously speculation within crypto picks up in the opposite direction and goes in the opposite way. And so really what we're just thinking about this slug of capital that sits behind the stablecoin is you want something that has a totally different risk exposure, i.e. the exact thing that we're trying to solve for, which is having bonds within the US bank. You just want that there as a safety layer and then the source of yield as well to sit behind it to cover for when our yields are not going in the right direction. That can sort of sit there as a piece of capital to just give people a bit of peace of mind. So yeah, that's how we sort of think about it.
Appreciate it. And so just kind of moving into how you view the market size for something like this. I think we're both on the same page that the market for the short perp side is massive. And that's probably, you know, the universe you can expand into, and particularly as the space expands and maybe even, you know, the addition of new assets. But yeah, curious expectations for market size, kind of just using what open interest looks like now and kind of how much it increases in these bull markets.
Yeah, I think probably two pieces of, or like events that we can look back on and as just like interesting case studies to think about a product like Athena. So don't know if you remember at the back end of 2022, we had that ETH proof of work arbitrage play where everyone was long spot ETH and then short the future to collect the proof of work airdrop. Conceptually, that's very similar to what Ethena is doing, right? We just didn't have the staking yield there. And what you saw during that sort of very brief period of time was open interest actually moved from $10 billion to $16 on just ETH contracts in that 2 week period and then unwound pretty quickly afterwards. And so we just look at that as like one interesting case study, which is like if there is the demand for a product like this to move into the market, the flows, and it happened in a pretty orderly way to actually take in $6 billion of flows in 2 weeks. So we look at that and think that there is sort of capacity within the market when there is an actual use and a demand for the derivative market to expand that it can. We saw that number shrink to somewhere closer to $4 billion at the bottom of the bear market. And when you saw some of the speculation sort of return in Q4 of last year, that number moved from $4 billion to closer to $7.5 billion in the space of just a month. And so, again, we look at these small pieces of data and just think it doesn't take a lot in terms of the move in sentiment for big changes in open interest. And if we just look at that move that we saw within the last 2 months, that's enough for Ethena to be successful, which is just sitting on the other side of that market flow that we saw in those last 2 months. So I think getting more directly to your question, I think low single-digit billions on just ETH is achievable with what Ethena's doing now. That assumes no growth in the derivative market, no growth in the ETH price itself. It starts to get interesting, obviously, when you think forward when ETH is at 4, 5, 6, 7, 8K. What we saw last cycle was actually the derivative market expanded quicker than market caps. So roughly the ratio was like 1.5x to a 1x increase in market cap. And so as the prices go up, actually the derivative market goes up like quicker than the prices. And so, yeah, we sort of look at it now. If nothing changes the market, there's low single-digit billions of capacity on just staked ETH versus ETH. Wherever the bull market sort of takes us this cycle, we think that could be multiples higher as the market expands. And then we haven't even jumped into like the idea of different assets. So obviously Arthur's idea was based on Bitcoin in the beginning. I'm not convinced that works at the bottom of a bear market. I think it makes a lot of sense when you're sort of at the beginning or midway through a bull where you don't really care if it has a staking yield on the asset side, if the basis in the futures markets are paying out 15, 20, 25%. BTC open interest like just cost over 20 billion, like leading into the ETFs at the moment. And so if you make the decision that you want to do this at slightly worse marginal economics with BTC, that's, we think, more than enough capacity to take you like above $10 million $10 billion on the stablecoin itself. And you can sort of think about the balance sheet of Ethena in that scenario as sort of shifting through time, where, as I said, I think the staked ETH versus ETH makes sense through the whole cycle, where whether you're at the bottom of a bear or the top of a bull, that sort of works. And so you can think of it as being mostly ETH denominated at the bottom. As the cycle expands, it's got more BTC in there, and then you unwind to a low supply. You're basically getting rid of the lower yielding assets and being left with the high stuff. So, yeah.
I'm glad you also mentioned in the beginning of that explanation the trade that was happening on ETH, which is if you're thinking about how this thing can do during tough times, you had bear market plus this unnatural amount of sell side pressure that would also bring funding down to as part of that trade. So the fact that you had all of those things kind of overlapping and you still only saw funding go negative for a temporary period, I think kind of speaks to the resilience of this model and how it all play out. You know, with crypto, because everything is live and intertwined, it makes it really fun, but also kind of scary. And so you really have to incorporate, you know, how one thing can affect another. And I think it's just the case with markets in general, but one of the typical kind of signs of froth in the market is just high funding rates. And that is usually, you know, a signal for some level of pullback, because the idea is people can't realistically be paying 30, 40% to go long for an extended period of time. And so, you know, there is this scenario where this grows in tandem with the market, but also keeps the market from overheating from a funding perspective, but still allowing price to kind of rally, right? Where you do have like exorbitant bullishness isn't penalized with high funding rates, but almost like, you know, this product benefits from it, but it also allows the market to kind of continue going higher potentially than it would otherwise by keeping these funding rates low. And so, yeah, curious, I'm sure, you know, outside of the day-to-day operations, you're thinking like long-term, what kind of impacts this can have on the market. But yeah, curious if you've gone down like some kind of mental rabbit holes of how things can play out in the long run.
Yeah, it is an interesting like question to think about, because you can think of it even, let's say we take the example of like staked ETH. You can think of the sort of product that we put together here as just using staked ETH. Really what you're playing is like the interest rate differential between dollars with USDC and what ETH is producing as an asset. So you can generally apply what we've described there to like a staked Solana or whatever it is. What's going to be happening is if we're bringing in dollar inflows and then shorting those assets on the other side, that obviously has like a net negative impact to just like the overall price action for whatever asset we're using there on the other side. And so there is, at a certain size, maybe, you know, second order implications to just like the speed at which some of the other assets can sort of like increase if we are sort of that big and sort of shorting at that size on the other side of that trade. So yeah, I think that there could be interesting second order impacts like across the market from something sort of moving at the size. I think that is when we're just talking about risks, want to sort of jump into this one for sure, because I think people focus in on the funding risk a lot, and that's not actually the one that sort of keeps me up and night. It's more actually just thinking about liquidity coming into and out of the product, because you can think about when you're entering the product, you actually need to put on a hedge to obviously execute and issue the stablecoin in the beginning. And equally, when you're redeeming, you need to close out those shorts and then give the assets back to the user on the other side. Obviously, at small size, that sort of works within the market. Depth within these centralized exchanges on perhaps is significantly deeper than spot. So you can sort of get away close to $100 million and just Binance with less than 1% slippage on perhaps. But obviously, when you're dealing with stuff that's in billions, that becomes a bit of an issue if everyone's sort of wanting to get it out and in at the same time. So you can't sort of hide this risk. It just does exist. It's like a slippage of getting into and out of the transaction. But there is some risk that sort of exists around this, which is if you are moving at that sort of size relative to the total size of the market and everyone wants that at the same time, there's obviously going to be a cost to that liquidity, and we just need to be open and honest with the users on the other side that cost does exist, and that you might sort of have to pay that on the way out if everyone wants that at the same time.
Especially these stable coins, if you're not the one doing minting and redeeming, then the peg is as good as the liquidity, right? And that's what really drives the peg. But the real penalty is just people who have, you know, very short time preference, because everything is one-to-one collateralized. So it's more about wanting to get out for some reason ahead of time, where, you know, if time isn't as much of a concern, then you kind of allow market makers to bring in liquidity and repeg and then kind of get out at that time. But yeah, you're not really worrying about like a bank run type scenario, because it is all one-to-one collateralized. As you get much bigger and you start thinking about, you know, market share versus some of the larger incumbents like the Tethers and the USDCs, do you see a world where they potentially return this yield back? Right, for them, their yield is a function of kind of treasuries, and it's reasonable to expect that we're near cycle highs on those yields, and so to some extent their yields probably compress, which shouldn't really necessarily impact their supply because it's just more underlying business. But do you see a world where they're distributing yield, or do they kind of, is their moat purely on the liquidity and integration side, and they'll continue playing that game?
Yeah, I do think it is a question of like Tether versus everyone else, basically, where I think Tether's just got such a dominant position and serves such a different niche of the market that they're never going to share the yield with anyone on the other side. USDC, to some extent, already is in the partnerships that they have with Coinbase. So if you're there on the Coinbase platform, they're sort of flashing 4% or 5% sometimes, which they're bucketing as like a marketing expense. But I think everyone sort of knows what's going on there behind it. So I think they're already feeling the pressure, and that new crop of RWA stablecoins that I described, it's really USDC that feels most of the pinch and the pressure there. I think like the backstory for this is really the holder base for USDC and like USDT looks extremely different, where there's only like 4% overlap between the holders of those two instruments, where Tether is basically massively Asian dominated by like large Asian entities, Asian exchanges, offshore exchanges, collateral within perhaps. Well, USDC has obviously gone a bit more within like the regulatory apparatus of the US and trying to sort of fit within fintech applications, payments, and then bits of DeFi as well. And so that second bucket over there, I think the capital that basically owns USDC is much more sensitive to interest rates, where it's able to basically jump out of USDC into T-bills within the US because, you know, they're not selling in Asia, they're happy to sort of KYC. And there isn't sort of as much of that shadow money that's sort of like locked within Tether. While with Tether, I think the moat that they've established around liquidity sitting on exchanges, being the main collateral for perhaps on linear contract, and then just the integration that they have through like offshore outside of the US entities means that they just have such a dominant position that they won't pay out.
And moving on to the stablecoin itself, USDE, can we touch a bit on kind of how the yield itself will be kind of captured by holders and what you envision for the future of that token, whether it's, you know, integrations or things built on top?
Yeah, so the model we've taken looks like pretty similar to DAI and SDAI. So we've delineated pretty clearly between the stablecoin itself and then the instrument, which actually captures that return. So if you take USD and just take it in a contract that looks very similar to SDAI, you're basically just accruing that yield there. It's not rebasing. What we do think is like quite interesting about this is actually think about like what is the innovation that can come when you have a yield that's actually above the market that you can sort of sustain at billions of size. If we look at all of the applications that are built now around whether it's RWAs or LSTs, it's not that interesting to be doing stuff with like money markets, for example, where the borrow cost on dollars is basically the same as the yield that you're generating on the asset side. It's only when you see differences there where using all those different applications in weird and interesting ways starts to open up like interesting post-leverage returns. So one very basic example here is if you're producing, I'm just looking at the USD APY right now, it's just at 19%. So just quoting this on the day. If you have that asset sitting there within a money market and you have the ability to borrow at 5 or 6, that obviously opens up all the like interesting experimentation that we saw in terms of leverage returns within 2021. And really your moat here is that the rest of DeFi has no access to the source of yield. They're all basically fighting off the two same sources. And this is like something that you actually hold, we think, pretty interesting power to be able to start like integrating this source of yield into different applications. I think the other piece is around also thinking about fixed rate instruments that can be built upon this. So obviously a perpetual and the staking yield are both floating rate on both sides of that transaction. But there's a pretty deep dated futures market within crypto as well. So your ability to basically use expiring futures instead of perps to take out the hedge means you can put down staked ETH collateral, hedge forward 6 months in time, but actually know the rate that you're locking in for that period of time. So that becomes a pretty interesting instrument where someone doesn't want to take the naked risk of funding jumping from like 10 to 20 to 30 in the space of a month and just wants to sort of lock in above market returns on an expiring future. We think that type of asset is quite interesting to start plugging into treasuries or reserve assets within DeFi as well. And then I think just getting back to the same point that we've sort of labored throughout here, which is this really starts to shine when rates in the real world start to come down because of that weak negative correlation that we described. And so to the extent that you've got applications like Maker or Frax, which rely very heavily on RWAs being at 5%, when that starts to move from 5 to 4 to 3 and the yield on this product goes directly the opposite way, again, we just think this is a pretty interesting way to basically import and tokenize that basis from sexes into these applications as well. And then I think the final one to also touch on is just thinking about yield-bearing collateral on exchanges. So we saw Avo come out with something pretty interesting recently where the actual collateral that you're holding to margin the perps has got like an embedded yield sitting within that. And I just think from like a capital efficiency perspective, it's quite interesting to think about having your dollar margin collateral producing a whatever 10 to 20% yield and then going long on perps on the other side. I'm sure people are going to take that too far, but I think it is interesting to think about nonetheless.
Yeah, no, absolutely. One of the ways that, you know, a stablecoin quote unquote wins is having your stablecoin denominated pairs on these exchanges, both in terms of like mind share and utility and liquidity. It's very compelling, right? The idea that you can have your collateral effectively paying the funding rate for you to be long becomes a really useful tool for traders and anyone passively holding these exposures.
Reminds me of that made with an elephant.
Or like the surge protector where it's just like plugged into itself. Yeah, and everyone's kind of favorite time is, when governance token and how are you thinking about value capture for it and long-run plans there?
Yeah, we haven't really got like any set sort of plans on that. But what I would say is that there's obviously a very clear way that this can extract value, right? So you are producing a yield that's significantly above the market most of the time. And if we just think about what is your ability as a protocol to sort of extract value, it's always trying to deliver some form of alpha. So if we look at like an RWA or an LST, you're taking a 5%, 4 to 5% on the yield, clipping 10% for an LST and then paying halfway to validators, or like an RWA is taking in like 20 basis points. Net net, you're basically only producing like 20 basis points in whatever assets are sitting within there, which is just not a very interesting business model unless you're doing it at absolutely enormous scale. What's interesting about this, and I think it gets back to the scalability point that you're making earlier, is if you're producing a yield that's at 10 to 20% and the other way in the rest of the market's at 5, you obviously just have a lot more scope there to actually decide how much can sort of come back to the protocol and actually be captured there as value. And so we sort of think about it as the protocol sort of delivering alpha here, which is bringing in that undifferentiated source of yield as a single instrument into DeFi. And to the extent that you want to think about using that to either grow the insurance fund and just make the product more safe for everyone else going forward and sort of increasing the optionality that you have to do new and interesting things with the product, That's one avenue to use that cash. The other one is thinking about business development. So the product is obviously quite interesting to centralized exchanges, where you're trading on centralized exchanges, you're using their liquid staking tokens, and you're increasing liquidity and open interest on their venues as well. And so we sort of look at that and think they are incentivized to push this versus a Tether on their exchange. And to the extent you want to sort of share some of that yield and decide that the cash flows go there to basically push adoption, that's, I think, one other avenue that sort of the protocol can be deciding through a token. And then finally, if those sort of things are exhausted, you can just potentially think about capturing it directly as just a source of cash flow.
And moving on to more near-term things, you know, you've recently opened up the ability for people to deposit into the initial kind of supply, and you know, we're also happily participating in that, and kind of wanted to go into, you know, how things are going on that front and what near-term kind of milestones are.
Yeah, so I basically opened up like a bit of a guarded launch before we open up to the public at the end of this month. The idea here is that we obviously are doing quite a bit here, which is actually just net new, and we just wanted to make sure that the system was like as safe and secure for retail users who come in eventually. So the idea is we're just trying to build up some liquidity now, make sure that all of the custodial addresses and exchanges have been like seeded in the right way, and that everyone's comfortable before fully opening up. So the intention here was just to build up some liquidity on chain and then open up for a more public sort of airdrop type campaign to come out at the end of this month. And yeah, well, I think we're very fortunate with the market dynamics, as we sort of described through the chat. I think all of the movements in open interest, all the movements in funding were very much in our favor. So I think the team did an awesome job sort of executing. I think we've got up to just over 120 million now in just over a month. I think that'll be closer to 200-ish by the time it's sort of like fully out in a couple of weeks. And yeah, I think a lot of it down to just being very fortunate around the market timing, where I think the dynamics sort of are really shining right now for a product like this.
Yeah, no, I think the timing couldn't have worked out better. You had the empirical data necessary to kind of move the viability and the resilience of the model, the macro element of yield being prevalent and people liking it, to now knowing that it's slowly going to be pulled away. And at the same time, yields out there come down, which fuels speculation and drives the yields on this platform. So yeah, the kind of the inverse relationship between Fed funds rate and the yields for USDE is pretty amazing. Just for the listeners, what's the best way to kind of keep up with what you're building and you specifically as well?
Yeah, the website's athena.fi. Twitter's athena_labs, and then I'm on a fairly cryptic account called leptocratic_. And yeah, as I said, everything will be a bit more sort of public at the end of this month, where everyone can come in and participate. And would obviously love any of the listeners who want to get involved in any way, do reach out.
Absolutely, really appreciate you coming on and chatting.
Awesome, man, appreciate it, thank you.